From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood.
Hollywood Hour.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Welcome to the Blue Swallow Motel in Tucumcari, New Mexico, on an unseasonably rainy night here on the road. Road trip day. Oh, man, what is it? I was told there'd be no math. Day 29 of 32. This is your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness, and sitting alongside me, actress, producer, president of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, Lily Holloman.
This is Lily Holloman. How you doing? You're listening to Roadside Conversations with Lil and Phil.
No, that's not what they're listening to. They're listening to their Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and this is another kind of a pastiche, an oral pastiche, as it were, of a podcast. Later on in the show, you're going to hear Dean Haglund, Bruce Harwood, Tom Braidwood, the Lone Gunman, answering questions from a moderator and from audience members at a panel that took place in Dallas. If you've been listening the last couple weeks, you've heard other pieces from the Dallas convention, MonsterCon, that took place. When was this? This feels ages ago, but it was only Memorial Day weekend. But until then, Lil, there's a few things that I want to discuss with you.
Well, first of all, I would like to add that I did tell Dean that he should change his name to Hagwood, so it would be Three Woods. And he said no one had ever suggested that to him before, and he would take it under advisement, but that the other two, Tom and Bruce, would be more probably likely to change their last name to Lund.
Okay, none of this is what I wanted to talk about. They're going to be a big part of the show later on. And now, late at night, 2 days late, you're making me have to edit, which I don't appreciate.
Well, I like that part.
But tell this story, though. You were in Dallas with us, and you really struck up a friendship with the Lone Gunman. You were especially of the belief that you and Bruce Harwood were fast friends, and but you weren't sure. You Tom Braidwood seemed to be a tough nut to crack. You weren't sure whether you'd really struck up a friendship with him. So when the weekend was over, and you were saying goodbye to them, and what did you say to Bruce Harwood?
I said, it was so great meeting you. I will definitely look you up when I'm in Vancouver next. And he said, well, yes. I mean, you should at least enjoy Vancouver.
And then, not sure how to respond to that, you offered an invitation should he ever be in Los Angeles, and he cut you off with...
No, that probably will never happen.
Okay, but meanwhile, Tom Braidwood goes out of his way, the one you weren't sure you won over, he goes out of his way to make it clear that he and his wife would be happy to see you.
Yes, so we're heading up there tomorrow,
actually. that's day 30, and then we're still going to be back in L.A. on 32. We have been many places just today. But before I get to that, happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
Are you disappointed not to be in Los Angeles celebrating your birthday at the Los Angeles Breakfast Club?
No, because I like my birthday to extend. So I have a feeling we will celebrate upon my return.
Okay. Well, we've celebrated on the road by doing a particular exploration, an exploration with a particular emphasis, and that is Route 66, the Mother Road. On your birthday, which was Monday, We made it to northeast Oklahoma to begin exploring a stretch of Route 66 that we did not explore last year, and that is the Oklahoma stretch. In case there's anyone listening who does not know what Route 66 is, it was, as I said, the Mother Road. It was known as Main Street of America, and it was once the major thoroughfare connecting Chicago to Los Angeles, and we really have fallen in love with exploring both the restored and preserved aspects of the road and its roadside attractions, as well as its forgotten, derelict, and darn near destroyed attractions.
Oh, yeah.
And we've really been doing a good job these last 2 days. What are some of the highlights for you?
Highlights include the Catoosa Blue Whale. That's been, I would say a lifelong dream, because it has felt like a lifelong dream, but I really just found out about it about 6 months ago. But we met the Catoosa Blue Whale on the afternoon of my birthday. It was love at first sight. I was a little tense, to be honest, because I so admired this whale that I couldn't quite relax during the entire experience. I was a little starstruck, but I still very much appreciated meeting him, and would like to make that my house one day.
You want to live there. You want to live at the Blue Whale.
I do.
It was once a tiny little amusement theme park. It fell into, again, disrepair and disuse, and parts of it have been restored. It's a lovely little a roadside attraction. That's the best way to describe it. My favorite point of discovery, and they've all been good. I mean, we visited today in, what was it, Shamrock, Texas.
Yes.
A service station and cafe that is in the movie Cars. That's how iconic this place is. And a replica, a facsimile of it, exists in Disney California Adventure, the theme park.
Indeed.
So that was great. But my favorite part was where we had dinner last night in downtown Tulsa. And people don't realize that Route 66 went straight through the heart of Tulsa. And there we found a mid-century modern bank that at one point was the busiest auto park bank. Hundreds, if not thousands of cars driving through to do their business at this bank in Tulsa. Retro-futuristic. It was like the bank that Walt Disney would design in the late 50s of what next century banks will look like, because he hadn't predicted the ATM machine, so that there would be no banks at all. But this, it's like a set out of an alien world in the original Star Trek. That's how cool the retrofuturism is on this place. And it's been turned into a restaurant. And the food is outstanding. And the decor, incorporating not only the architecture, but many of the built-in design details, is just spectacularly fun as well. So that was my highlight, the Vault in Tulsa. When you find yourself in Tulsa, dine at the Vault. You'll thank me later. Tell them Chilpak Hollywood Hour sent you. And we had your favorite waiter of all time, didn't we?
Yes, he was the best waiter I've ever had. He was equal parts knowledgeable about the food, gregarious, and didn't want to be our friend. It was fantastic.
Because we go places to eat, we don't go to make friends.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Tim. I'll be your server this evening. Just let me know if there's anything you need. Tim, what I need is for you to take 2 steps back, certainly emotionally, maybe physically, perhaps you could just lie down in the back of the restaurant for a little while and let us look at the menu.
Yeah, he never even told us his name.
He did not.
That was great.
No, I think on the receipt it said server 301. So he may just have been a robot, a retro-futuristic robot, you know, the animatronics, the Disney animatronics programmed just to your birthday specifications.
I think so.
It was Westworld, if Westworld were a show about dining on Route 66.
In mid-century modern buildings.
So, Lil, you skipped out on part of the big road trip.
I did.
To go shoot a movie back in Los Angeles.
Yes, if they're calling them that these days. It is a movie.
Los Angeles?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, that was.
They're still calling those people. Yeah. So my first.
It was a moving picture.
So my first question to you, Lillian, about being back in Los Angeles shooting this movie is, how's Fuzz Aldrin doing?
Fuzz Aldrin is doing great. She gets a little stressed out when we leave her, regardless of the excellent care she's been given. When we depart town, she's got abandonment issues, so she does stress. But I told her, we'll always take care of her, and, you know, she needs to stay around for a while. So I think that relaxed her, and she's been well.
As you know, I send messages to her.
Yes, one morning I heard Phil telling someone that he loved them in the bathroom.
I came out of the bathroom, and you were, I don't know, bemused or puzzled or what, but you said, who are you talking to? And I was so confused. I said, I was going to the bathroom. I was in the bathroom. I was showering, whatever it was. And you said, you told someone you love them. And sure enough, yeah, you learned my secret, which is that at least once or twice a day I've been meditating and sending messages to Fuzz Aldrin, usually visual images, but, you know, letting her know, which you witnessed before we left. I send her messages, visual messages, and to try to calm her. And
oh, it was a very funny thing to hear, because it was very like fatherly. You're like, all right, I love you.
Oh my goodness. Oh, that's really funny. That's really, really bizarre. I have deep emotional problems, especially where the cat is concerned. All right, so tell me about the movie. You went and shot this movie. It's called Funny Story.
Indeed. It is called that. It's an indie feature. It is written, directed, produced by Michael Gallagher, who has a very popular YouTube channel called Totally Sketch. And he and his fiance have been together since Chapman University, and they produced the film that I starred in called At Your Friends, which went to Slam Dance in 2010.
Look, you won all sorts of awards for that. You don't need to keep bringing it up.
That's true.
It's time to stop dining out on all those At Your Friends awards you won. So this one, yeah, they continue to do really interesting stuff, shorts and features, and often cast you. But not only do they cast you, they give you really, really good roles to play.
Yes.
Chances to do things you haven't done before.
Yes, and it's such a relief when you find people who have faith in you.
I find most people have faith in me. and far from being a relief, it's such a burden. It's a crown of thorns. Other people's faith is a crown of thorns.
Well, no, as an actor, when somebody can really understand the range of abilities that you have, it's quite a gift. So I always love working with them. The set is fun, and everybody is joking around and having a great time.
So who do you play, and what's it about?
I play Moon River.
You know, because here's the thing. Nobody mm-hmm. cares if it was fun. Nobody cares. None of us care. I make movies, and I don't care if people had fun making them. Because that doesn't translate to them being good. Nor does it translate to them being bad. And I understand when you're doing it, it is fun to do it. But none of our listeners care. Well, they don't. They may say they care, but they don't care.
I know.
So what is it?
True.
What is it about, and who do you play?
It is about a man and his grown daughter and their broken relationship. And there's a road trip involved and a trip to the Redwood Forest with the father, the grown daughter, and all of her women friends.
Okay.
And I am one of the women friends.
And the big piece of the movie, the big payoff of the movie, takes place at a destination wedding, right? Yes.
I don't know if I'm supposed to say that or not.
Well, I just did. I just did. And you...
Anyway, I play one of the lady friends.
And you perform the wedding.
I officiate, yes.
I mean, this is a big deal... comic relief supporting character.
Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, for those people who don't remember, there was a little indie more than 20 years ago now that launched a bunch of careers called Four Weddings and a Funeral. And other than Hugh Grant, who of course was a huge breakout, and Kristin Scott Thomas was in that. People forget about that, but that did very well for her. And some other people as well. I mean, Andy McDowell already had a career. But on these shores, the big breakout supporting part, Rowan Atkinson. And why? Because he officiates the funniest wedding.
And I have often been compared to Rowan Atkinson.
You have.
Mr. Bean, yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Bean. So, but the point that I'm making is none whatsoever, except a question. Which is, would officiating a wedding, especially a comedic wedding, be something that had been on your bucket list as an actor?
Oh, that's a really great question, because I do have this list of kind of classic movie experiences.
Right.
I started a slow clap in a stadium at a high school homecoming queen pageant. Slow clap, y'all. Slow clap.
Yeah, that's great.
I started a slow clap.
Right.
Just to make sure you understood that.
No.
So that was a huge bucket list item. I hadn't considered officiating a wedding in a movie, but now that I've done it, I would add it to the list.
Yeah, it should have been on there. Just like my to-do list, I'll add things that I've done that weren't on the to-do list,
yeah,
just so it looks like I got more done.
But I would also definitely like to save Christmas at some point on that list. It's not in the movie I would just film, but just to clarify.
Right. You mean like, oh, it doesn't look like we're going to have Christmas this
yes.
year. Yes. But wait, here's Lily Holloman.
Exactly.
So,
but I never actually got around to talking about my character.
I don't know if people can hear this, but this is thunder outside. It's the first day of summer tomorrow. And we got we have been lightning
okay.
rods in our lives, in our careers, but never more so have we been lightning rods than driving throughout the South on the road home on this trip. We have hit the most amazing lightning and thunderstorms several days ago on Friday heading into the Mississippi Delta, on Sunday night in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and here we are Tuesday night in Tucumcari. And we're lightning rods.
Well, that's true. And Phil is from the West Coast, so he doesn't understand that East Coast, especially in the South, it's lots of summer storms. That's a good summer thing. So, it's exciting.
Everywhere we go, people talk about how they haven't been having them. They weren't expecting them. We show up. We come through like the locusts. And we leave... rain in our wake. I don't know. That wasn't the greatest analogy. But what I'm trying to get at is you played the auto harp in this movie that you shot.
I played a character named Moon River, which might be why I keep bringing water to places. Maybe it's me.
That's good. That's really, really good. And the instrument you played was the auto harp.
Yes, I learned the auto harp in 2 days. I got an email from the director, and he said, "Do you know how to play auto harp?" And I watched a YouTube video, and to be frank, it looked really easy, and lo and behold, it is kind of easy. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this instrument, but it's, Dolly Parton uses it a lot. The Carter family uses it. It's basically a mini harp with buttons that you push for the chords. So,
are they still an ongoing concern? The original family of country music, are they still recording?
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
All right, because you did that in present tense. And, you know, odd thing, we went to Bristol, Virginia. Bristol, Virginia bills itself as the birthplace of country music because
They had a recording studio where the Carter family made their first recording.
Okay, so it's Bristol, Virginia, birthplace of country music, the birthplace of country music museum, therefore also in Bristol, Virginia. But here's the deal, the recording studio where those sessions took place, across the main street, which is State Street, in another state, in Bristol, Tennessee. People may have seen Bristol, downtown Bristol, in that Geico commercial, but literally the state line separating Tennessee from Virginia goes down the middle of the main historic Main Street district called State Street. And yet the recording studio is in the Tennessee side, but the Virginia side claims to be the birthplace of country music. Now, I said this was interesting. Maybe that was a loose def. You need to loosely define.
Phil loves weird border stuff. He likes, you know, he scoped out on the map, you know, where there's like a corner with three states. Is there always three states on a corner? I don't know. He loves anything with a strange border situation. So that's why we went there. We actually saw the Geico commercial. He denies that that's the reason why we stopped there, but it's 100% true. We stopped in Bristol because of the Geico commercial.
When you keep referring to me in third person, like I'm not here, who is it that you're talking to?
The listening audience.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my God. All right. So we've covered your movie. And very cool that it all came together, especially that they could film your sequences not only in the few days you gave them, but that it fell right between here are these scenes involving you officiating a wedding fall right between you attending two very unusual weddings.
Yes, and it was kismet, I guess. Two real weddings and a fake wedding.
And I said unusual because these were out of the ordinary. I don't know if there is an ordinary kind of wedding, but they were both delightfully, in my experience, out of the ordinary.
Yes.
One in Washington, D.C. and one in the Mississippi Delta. And
both in backyards of homes.
Oh, that's true. That's true. And both were just great, great times. So, Lil, the other thing we need to talk about, I guess, unless there's anything... Well, two things, actually, that we need to talk about. I mentioned that you're the president in the Los Angeles Breakfast Club. I've talked about the Breakfast Club on this show. Dean has mentioned it from time to time. If he was living in Los Angeles, of course, he would be a member. And I've started a podcast.
Dean Hagwood.
I've started a, now I can't cut out, see, that was very smart of you, because now I can't edit out the story at the beginning, or I'd have to go through the weeds to cut out that little reference. I've been doing for 5 months now, a monthly podcast about the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, and as soon as we get back to LA, I gotta get episode 6 cut together. But is there anything coming up at the Breakfast Club that you are particularly enthusiastic about?
Well, there's a couple of members-only exclusive events that I'm very excited about. The day after we returned to L.A. on a Sunday, we're having a special private tour of the Museum of Neon Art in Glendale by Eric Linksweiler, who's one of the preeminent neon historians.
He literally wrote the book. Literally wrote the book on neon art.
He would be so jealous that we're at the Blue Swallow Hotel right now. He's never actually been here. I mean, he's got to come out because this sign is the crown jewel of neon.
Well, the entire courtyard.
Yeah.
The entire courtyard is aglow with neon majesty. All right. There's that. Anything else? Other presentations?
There's a presentation by an archivist with the Photo Friends through the LA Library, who's going to come and talk about the Bob Baker marionette collection.
Wow, you have just given my global audience the most site-specific presentation. I mean, that is something.
Everybody from around the world should come to LA before this tiny, tiny puppet theater closes. It's a Bob Baker marionette. It was opened in the 1960s by Bob Baker himself. You know who I'm talking about. The puppeteer.
Come on, German fans. You know who she's talking about.
But it is a time warp. You go in there and it has not changed since the early 1960s.
In fact, I'm willing to throw this offer out to all our listeners from Sydney, Australia. If you show your passport and mention Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at the Bob Baker Marionette Theater between now and the time it closes, you will get $1 off admission. Yeah, and if they don't honor that, just see me and I'll give you a buck.
Yeah. But not only do they put on a full puppet show with these amazing handmade marionettes from that time, then you go into the birthday party ice cream room and always have little tiny cups of ice cream with little wooden spatulas.
Spoons. Little wooden spoons. Okay, so you come for the threadbare decades-old marionettes and you stay for the carnation ice cream.
Anyway,
it's cool. Look, I'm making fun. I mean, it is.
It is really cool.
It's an important piece of Hollywood history. And
The Breakfast Club Foundation sponsored archiving all of the puppets through photographs, and she's going to come and make a presentation about those on July 19th.
You know, I'm a part of that foundation.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah. Okay, Lil, Twin Peaks is back.
Yes.
And certainly Dean and I haven't really discussed it, save a brief exchange, really between, I think, Bruce and me a couple weeks ago. But
Bruce Hardland?
But this show is just crushing it. David Lynch and Mark Frost are just absolutely crushing it. It is not only the best, maybe the best work Lynch has done. It's certainly a culmination of everything he's done. It's the best television on television, but also some really great performers are getting a chance to strut their stuff in a way they haven't in a long time, if ever. Not just Kyle MacLachlan, but Naomi Watts is just...
Oh, yeah. It's a wonderful combination of him being able to take 16 hours to explore narrative.
17.
Having the budget to make it look great, and also having the restrictions of the television format, of having producers in a network, and not a lot of restrictions. He seems to be able to do what he needs to do, but the structure, you know, he has something to push off against.
Yeah, and because although 17 hours seems like, well, what's the restriction? Because he said, don't think of this as an episodic television show, think of this as a 17-hour movie that's cut up to give to you in pieces. And really, like, the reviewers and the bloggers are starting to realize now that seven episodes have aired, damn if he wasn't telling the truth, because there are other, you know, showrunners who have taken that approach and have made that claim. And yet still, yes, even great shows like Breaking Bad or Fargo might have all the quality of a great indie movie, all right? Of Days Gone By. They may have all the quality of that and all of the character, and the narrative is coming out of character. But still, even with a continuing storyline, there's a degree to which every episode stands alone. Every episode has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It follows a multiple act structure each episode. Twin Peaks: The Return eschews that all together.
Mm-hmm.
There is no structural through line to these, what we're going to call episodes, through these hours of them. There isn't. But once you got through the end of episode 5 and 6, you realized, okay, that was the end of act one. It really was. And by episode 7, we are firmly into act 2 now and heading towards what we expect to be some kind of narrative midpoint reversal. Now, all that said, that's the restriction that you're talking about. Because in his movies, when he's produced them himself, like Inland Empire, there wasn't as much structural cohesiveness as there is now. But again, what's fascinating is it's the structural cohesiveness of a movie, not of a TV show.
It feels like the culmination of everything he's been experimenting with that came before in really expert artistic execution.
We will maybe get back together to discuss this when the show has run its course. I'm not going to give any spoilers to anyone. However, again, if you haven't been watching it, and you think you got to go back and watch the original show, I know so many people who are binge-watching the original show. One of the things they've done quite well is to explain to you while watching this series what happened in the old show. Those plot points you get reminded of, they get explained in occasionally some very delightful expositional scenes,
mm-hmm.
That are really some of the funniest scenes. What you would be well served to be familiar with is the film that came out after the series that was a prequel called Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, and honestly read Mark Frost's book, The Secret History of Twin Peaks. This is where they're really drawing from and where a good knowledge is helpful.
I guess, but I would argue that if you have seen the original series and know Dale Cooper really well. Whoa, and somebody agrees with me.
No, they disagree with you.
Oh, whatever. I think it's good to know who Dale Cooper was in the original series.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, I'm not saying don't watch the original series, but I am saying I think people are giving these other pieces short shrift, and even Lynch himself, and this is why Mark Frost wrote the book, was these are important pieces to understanding, again, not understanding in terms of plot. This is how people think, and if you're approaching it about plot with David Lynch, there is plot, and there are answers, and there are solutions. But David Lynch's work makes sense, and you and I have discussed this a lot, they make sense emotionally. Because he is a genuine seeker of what it means to be human, of the human experience. And that is an experience that is meant to be lived emotionally. And that, you know, that a narrative construct is a product of the conscious mind, and David Lynch is far more interested in the unconscious patternings that affect our emotional experiences.
Absolutely. And I started crying at one point during episode 3-4, not because the scenes were emotional, but, or they were emotional, but not because they were sad scenes, but because it reminded me how few artists we have of the quality of David Lynch making films, TV, today.
I may have mentioned this on an earlier show, but our friend Luke White Thompson, in his review for Forbes, he wrote, his headline was along the lines of David Lynch's Return to Twin Peaks proves that, yes, we can have nice things. And it is so emotional for me to think that 25 years later, which in some ways feels like a blink of an eye, Lynch is back at the peak of his game and giving us what we really need. So let's come back, revisit the Return to Twin Peaks when the whole show has been released. But before we sign off and hand it off to the aforementioned panel featuring the Lone Gunman, tell about your experience of how you saw parts 3 and 4, which were aired back to back on a Sunday night, Memorial Day weekend. And you saw them in a very, very cool setting.
Yeah, I went to see it at the Texas Theater in Dallas.
The Oak Cliff neighborhood.
The Oak Cliff neighborhood in Dallas, which is where Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested on the day that JFK was assassinated. He ran into the theater and sat in one of the seats.
After allegedly shooting a police officer, he fled into the Texas Theater.
And they raided the theater and dragged him out. And many, many years later, it has been restored. And it's a great venue. If you're ever in Dallas, I highly recommend checking it out. They show mostly vintage movies. They did not advertise or charge to show Twin Peaks because obviously they weren't allowed to make money off of it. But I got the inside word that they were doing that, and so was able to watch it on the big screen. And that was...
I think they were calling
really
it...
really added to the experience.
Weren't they calling it Black Lodge Nights?
Yeah.
And that's very, very cool. All right, Lil, thanks. We'll see you on the road.
See you on the road.
All right, everybody. Here, like I promised, here's the panel discussion from Dallas, The Lone Gunman. Hopefully it won't be hard to hear, but if it is, I promise we'll do better next time.
Our next guests were a mainstay on the show The X-Files, and I've never had a chance to meet any of them yet, and I've got so many questions. We all have questions, and I will agree in advance that none of them have any idea what Chris Carter is doing. They do not have the answers. They do not know what the black goo is. We will find out what they do know. Please say hello to The Lone Gunman. We have cards. Yeah,
we're going in order.
No, don't go in order. We should just sit down where it is.
Well, let's see, my age is that I don't know what this is. It's FBI's Agents, never heard of the show. enough, in the audition room, normally you read with other guys with long hair. Like, it's all the same long-haired guys reading for crackhead and drug dealer and stuff like that. And so we came in, and because everybody didn't know what they wanted, it was comedians, it was bald-headed muscle guys in fatigues, it was across the board. They had brought in everybody to try to figure out who these characters are. And I'm like, I think I'm in the wrong room. These are none of the guys I normally audition with. And then we read, and then I kept reading with other actors who were running for buyer's role, and including from Stargate, Walter Harrington, my best friend Gary Jones, auditioned to be buyers, and we sent out to, oh, we'd be so cool, we're best friends, and we'd be in this thing, and he didn't get it. Anyway, so I had no idea what the hell was going on in my agent, so, and still don't. What did Madeline
do? Well, I mean, she phoned me up and said, have you ever heard of the show called Rustling Paper, The X-Files? And I said, no, what's that about? So it's these FBI agents, and they chase UFOs and stuff. And I said, that sounds like the stupidest idea. and I read the sides, and it said in the sides that my character was clean-shaven, and I just broke the spirit. And I went, oh, well, we'll get the part because I think most producers lack imagination. So really, when you're in an audition, you have to help them along. You have to encourage them to believe it could be a role. And I figured, little beard, not him. And I went in and read once, got the part.
Right, we didn't even read together.
Yeah.
We didn't meet until the trailer.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then we didn't meet Tom until...
Well, it was a little bit different for me. I had been an actor, but when I was in the theater a long time ago, and then I left that, got behind the camera in film, and that's kind of where I've been for 20 years. I was actually the assistant director of the show, the assistant director of the show that these guys were showing up in, and the director was having a hard time passing the part to try to show drive. He just wasn't happy with everybody. The funny thing was that he and I, the director, wonderful guy named Billy Graham, had worked together like 15 years before on this ridiculous western with Bruce Sterling in the Snow Country, and we kind of became friends, but not close friends. And he remembered me really, really well. But apparently, at some point in the auditions, when he was doing Corey, he was really unhappy about the whole thing. He turned to Chris Carter. That's a story. You know, we need somebody slimy, somebody like Braidwood.
Nailed it.
I was coming out of the chorus room while they were coming out of the casting, and they all sat and looked at me and said, ah, poor Braidwood. And there it was. So he asked me if I do it, I said, well, one line of dialogue, right? Which was a bench and stretch of the two. But that was it, so I said, sure. And I didn't think about it much. I just.
Because at the time, it was only going to be the one episode.
Yeah.
So it was like, oh yeah, just give that one line to the AD. How hard can that be?
Yeah. We'll never see him again.
All those guys.
Yeah, that's the funny thing too about TV, especially when you're working in Hollywood. You've got a ton of appearances and one-liners, and you got your day rate and the rest of it. So how surprising was it that the fan reaction was so strong at a time when there wasn't really social media or the web or the internet to power something?
Well, it really was the first, because I know I was at university still, I think, because I had all my computer science friends, and they were teaching me Unix code to get onto a Amber screen, which was a alt TV X-Files news group, and then we would search Lone Gunman, RN/RN Gunman, and then it would come up all the feeds on the chat, and then when we showed up, they went, aha, this proves that Chris Carter and the producers are lurking in their newsgroup because they created characters that are reflecting this culture. And then Chris Carter actually admitted, yeah, that's exactly what we were doing. So then we would bring back the government to ramp up the alt-TV X-Files newsgroup chat. And then this became a symbiotic relationship between internet fans. It's one of the first TV shows to do that. Now it's expected.
Like now, you know, you can't even get a TV show unless you have 10,000 fans already following you for a show that doesn't exist.
So, Puerto Rico.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about that. But yeah,
it's the podcast.
I see.
Yours is we had no idea we were going to get called back. Yeah, you know, sure.
In fact, if you look at the first 3 to 5 episodes, my glasses are different. Because they just came from a giant plastic bag of prop glasses, and then I would just chuck them back in, and then walk away. And then the prop guy goes, "Do you remember which glasses you wore last night?" Let me just dig through. Did this look back? Not really.
Yeah, try it.
That's close enough. Get out there.
With the show on Xbox, with a very limited production time for each episode, you know, when it's an effects lady, as a lot of them are, there's not a lot of room for give and take on figuring out who your characters are as far as the writers go. So I'm curious, did you have a chance to powwow and try to flesh these characters out, or was it all just get in there, do your lines, and get the hell out of
the Exactly.
It's pretty much was the case. We just kind of fell into the natural rhythm, you know, from the very first time we did it, that whatever relationship kind of happened then, it just kind of grew out of that. We never really talked about it or analyzed it.
Early
on, too, the dialogue, at least I got, was such a mouthful. It was just getting through the lines.
Yeah.
There was like that thing about, like, in our second appearance on Blood, I had to talk about fruit flies or something like that. And kill me trying to get all that stuff.
Oh, right.
So I was never thinking, my whole entire character was get the lines right.
I know, there'd be like, they would take lines from the newsgroup sometimes. So I had to say, hey, Mulder, you want to hop on the internet and nitpick the scientific inaccuracies of Earth 2? Just like, okay, get that one taken.
If you guys have any questions, we don't have any crowd mics, but I think we're an intimate group, so we all come and love each other.
Do you, sir, live in Australia?
That is correct.
I heard you interview on an international talk show, and you were telling us that you can hear spiders are so big you can hear it. Is that
true? Yeah. What international talk show were you listening to?
Maybe it was supposed
to come today. Oh, maybe. Sure. Yeah, I've been on that one. Yeah, there's spiders and snakes in Australia. I moved there 2.5 years ago because my better half got promoted in her job, and it's geographically irrelevant where you be in that these days, so because we're all connected. So.
How big is a spider you can hear?
Okay, so the high school spider. Yeah, I have a picture of it. My hand is beside it on the wall, and it's the same size as my hand. So this spider goes across one evening, we're watching TV, and it's on the hardwood floor, and it's like it's tap dancing. So you can hear it go click, 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 click. And we're like, listening to go, what's all that clicking sound? And then we turn, and there it is, walking across the floor. And so we spook it, and then it tries to speed up, but it's like a Marty Muddle in the Flintstones. It's like, it can't get traction on the hardwood floor until it gets up to the wall. When you see a giant spider, the last thing you think of, where's the camera?
Really, I mean, you start telling me that story and I want to run out of the room.
Well, luckily it's not poisonous, and it eats cockroaches and ants and stuff, but it can also, there's one guy has a video of a huntsman on his fridge with a mouse.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's got a live, it's eaten a mouse. So that's how big the spider is, it can detect and catch mice.
So it doesn't
have a cat, it's that, like, you let the huntsmen hang around your house and go to the giant, scary bucket things on
the wall.
This will bring one next time.
I'm sorry,
say that
again.
Maybe you can bring one next time.
No, well,
there's a biosecurity law, as we learned from Johnny Depp, that they're very much not into transporting creatures across that. Because, you know, we have rabies here, but if rabies ever got there and they got to the kangaroos, it would wipe out the population. Because those kangaroos are big, they're muscular, and they can kick you. There's one that was like 6'7" and just like broad shouldered, and it wouldn't up in Brisbane. So they like, you know, they shoot it in a way that they would just sit there and like stare everybody down. And like cars had to drive around and stuff like that. It was not moving. So put rabies into that thing and everybody's dead.
Yeah. It's a great honor. I love y'all's characters and the fact that you were on more and more and just made the show great. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I think we've not figured out where our next sci-fi number movie is.
I was wondering if you guys could discuss the one shot of the president and maybe reflect a little bit on how kind of prophetic the subject matter
is. Right. However, it was 13 episodes, it wasn't just the pilot.
Right.
Yeah.
We put that in.
Yeah. Did anybody see the Lone Gunman spin-off?
Absolutely.
Yay! Right. So, yeah, to reiterate the pilot episode, the plot was we stopped a plane from flying into the World Trade Center by overtaking its computer system and returning it back to the controls of the pilots. And then this happened 8 months?
About 8 months.
8 months before it actually happened in real life. And so it kind of freaked all of us
out. At the time, we were all in Los Angeles. Shooting an episode of The X-Files, and the September 11th was the day that Tom and I were to fly home to Vancouver. And I got woken by a phone call, 8:30 in the morning or 7 in the morning, and it was my driver, and he says, yeah, but you're not going to the airport today. All the planes are grounded. And I said, what? Why is that happening? He said, well, a plane has flown into the World Trade Center. And I thought, initially, that's funny. Yeah, nice joke. And then I went, no, he's the guys who pick us up and drive us to the airport, they have no idea who we are. It's just the job. And I thought initially, well, then it's like a single end, you know, like a Cessna or something. And then I put on CNN. And as you probably all remember that day, before it was being shown over and over from many, many angles. And like, how?
Hey, probably, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you said, turn on your
TV.
So we were there, we were in LA for, they tried to introduce, well, I'm sure probably there was a little odd things going on. LA was just a dead silence. We went up on the balcony of the hotel. You couldn't hear a car, you couldn't hear a plane. It was the oddest feeling. It was really odd.
Yeah.
And we were there. They tried to get us out.
They kept saying that, oh yeah, we'll put you on a flight as soon as they're available.
Yeah. And we were there for almost 5 days, 4 days.
4 days.
And finally we decided to be home because we were getting really nervous.
As aliens living in a...
Yeah.
In America, which was under attack.
We were
irrationally felt that we were better out of the country than...
Yeah. We were concerned that water would get...
Also, we were the home gunman. We were in a show where planes flew into the World Trade Center. Why wouldn't, you know, I mean, crazy paranoid, but why not arrest us?
Yeah. So we called Fox and said, find us a car that we can drop off in Canada and we'll get ourselves out there, and that's what we did.
Yeah.
We got in the car and we drove home.
I mean, he hadn't
driven in like 45 years.
He even showed the driving.
How long were you on the road?
It's like 48 hours.
We
stopped for like 3 hours and outside Mount Shasta or something like that?
Yeah. Right. So you just went to Vancouver, it's like straight
up.
And I remember when you crossed the border at like, was it 10 at night or something like that? You went, hooray! And he said, stop, they'll pull us over. Stop cheering.
I was living in Los Angeles by that time, and that day, oddly enough, I got a leak in my sink. So I couldn't even watch the TV because I was trying to repair this thing. And I went to Costco and it was the most nicest day. The staff was so polite. Normally Costco in Los Angeles, they're surly and they're unhelpful and they're yelling, you know, they just don't give a crap. Suddenly, because of this, everybody was so polite, helpful, trying to, oh, what's wrong with, oh, the sink opened, and then other plumbers were in there as well, because everybody had plumbing issues that day for some reason, and everybody was like, it was the nicest day in Home Depot and Costco ever, so that's how I remember that.
the show. It was pretty freaky for him and the producers to think that.
Right.
And we also think about how, at the time, so many of the government officials were going on television saying, this was unimaginable. And we were part of it.
We imagined it. It has been imagined, filmed, and aired.
Yeah.
And Condoleezza Rice, no, but in popular culture, there's no way, it's unprecedented.
We're like, we have this show. But at Fox, I buried the show, and I didn't really reappear until just Saturday night. And you could get it on the news.
Yeah, and I think we were sure that the public would not be available.
We thought about it.
Because they would have to leave it off the DVD.
What they had done originally, because the 24 had the same problem. And it wasn't even that a plane was, rerouted or hijacked. Just there was a plane exploded, and they were worried that that injury was going to
be
upset. So they actually did put both versions of the pilot out.
Right, Schwarzenegger had 22 episodes on
the
They yanked that from the theaters. Mm-hmm. And then my friends who were sci-fi writers, they wrote on Farscape and a ton of other stuff. And they had written this really weird thing called A Town Called Banana. And it was this surreal thing that everybody hated. And then the 9/12, their phone's ringing off the hook. Every studio wants to read This Town Called Banana. Because everybody freaked out going, what do we do now? We can't do any of these action things. We can't. Let's do that really stupid, surreal thing. Maybe that's exactly where our consciousness is at. And so suddenly, and of course, it never got made because it was stupid and weird. But
the log line for A Town Called Banana.
You don't even want that. Exactly. It was a surreal thing.
I'm curious if, after working on the show for a number of years as recurring characters, did your own paranoia start to get ratcheted up just a little bit, or is it, were you able to just leave it at the door when you left the soundstage?
Well, good question. I actually started meeting a lot of those, like Jordan Maxwell, Dr. Roger Lear, who had removed alien implants. I did a documentary called The Truth Is Out There, where the camera crew follows me around as I actually talk and interview with a lot of these guys that I met because of the X-Files and Vince. Goes, hey, do you want to meet these guys in real life who makes this on? And and then they would have outlandish theories or seemingly outlandish theories, and then you go, well, that can't be true. And then they have a stack of paper because they've spent their lives researching this stuff. They're not theorists, they're researchers, right? They have gone in, they have removed things from people's toes that shouldn't be there, a scar, that this the whole Dr. Roger Lear thing is quite a whole other panel. Come to my table, they'll tell you all about it. But so that as you try to refute this, or you go, well, that can't be right, then they go, well, here's this information. And then years pass, and then all of that sort of comes to pass. A lot of the stuff that they said, has now proven to be true. So you go, and then you do a comedy show.
That's
how you go. Yeah, exactly.
My paranoia was unrelated, because as an actor, I've been working for some time before I got on the show, but I'd never been recognized. And then, like 4 years into the X-Files series, suddenly people were starting to recognize me on the street, and I'm kind of poor with names, so people go like, oh, Bruce! Like, do I know you? Because only people who know me would do this. And so then I did go through about like a year and a half of just flinching. Every time someone recognized me. Because it was like, I don't know who you are. Give me some context, quick. But actually, I did get over
that. Did you?
Yeah.
But then there were times when people didn't recognize you.
Oh yeah, more often than not. Usually I would be standing between you two.
Right.
It's like I stand all alone, and you come in and go, I'll tell you this story. My wife has a trading card with a 3-gun, and she would be visiting with friends or going to parties or whatever, but I didn't have to be, I just wasn't working or whatever. And people would say, so what does your husband do? He's an actor. Oh, has he done anything we don't know about? Well, he's on the X-Files. I love the X-Files. Who is he? Oh, he plays one of the Lone Gunmen. Oh, I love those guys. They're great. So he's the short one, right? No, he's not short. Oh, he's the guy with the long blonde hair. No, he's not the guy with the long blonde hair. Well, who is he then? And then she'd pull out the card and they'd hold it up and they'd look and they'd go,
spoiler alert.